everybody. My name's Colin Ellis, author of Culture Fix, Culture Hacks, and The Hybrid Handbook. On the Culture Makers podcast, I ask leaders from around the world to share a little bit of their story and what works well for them in the world of workplace culture. I hope you enjoy today's show. Everybody, and welcome to another Culture Makers podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Martin Holdsworth, who is strategist, cyber, and digital at VMware. Now, prior to joining VMware in late 2021, Martin was the Asia Pacific leader for cybersecurity for a global systems integrator, a CISO for one of Australia's largest retailers, a senior leader for cybersecurity in a Big Four consulting firm, and a CIO, CTO in financial services. He's been about a bit. I think that's what we're trying to say here with his bio. He's a well-known influencer in the cyber industry, which I'm keen to talk to him about actually today, where he brings practical insights based on real-world experience. Whether it be a board or C-suite exec or a tech or business team, Martin is comfortable to educate, engage, and inspire others. And he joins me today from Brisbane. Hello, Martin.
Hey, Colin. Thank you for the opportunity and the warm welcome. I wish you could give that replay back to my mum so she could really realize how good I am, but that's very nice to be here with you today.
Every time I see my dad, so we're heading home, we're recording this in early 2022 and I'm heading home later this year, he's like, how are you going? How's work? I'm like, it's good. He's like, so what are you doing? I'm like, I sent you the books. It's the same, right? Our parents are like, yeah, we don't really understand what they do, but as long as they're happy.
Exactly.
That's the main thing. So Brisbane's home now. Was Brisbane home to begin with, Martin?
I grew up in Brisbane. Yeah, I grew up in Brisbane, Colin, and went to high school here and even went to university here, although university and I just didn't work well, but I did get through and I did get the piece of paper. But I have spent a lot of my time on the road, working in many, many countries, both across Europe and Asia and the US. But we've raised our family here, so I guess I call Australia home and Brisbane that's a special place where I love to live.
What did you study at uni, Martin, if you don't mind me asking?
I did a Bachelor of Informatics.
But wow.
Most unusual term. It's an IT computer science degree. I guess I was at university the third year that the university started offering IT. And Griffith University, being the university that they are, didn't want to call it computer science because that's just too normal. So they had to give us something fancy, something trendy. So informatics, or the study of information systems. And I did my degree there. And interesting enough, I'm still involved with the university, still sitting on its advisory council, and still involved with championing the university for what it's done. So that's what I studied.
Fabulous. So while you might have not agreed with university, you're doing everything you can to uplift it now. Good on you, mate. What was your first job, Martin? Where did it all start for you? What was that first foray into the workplace?
Yeah, well, as a kid, my dad was an accountant, and he was a public accountant to a lot of service stations or gas stations, and would have hundreds and hundreds into the books for. So my first job as a school kid was really riding the push bike to a local service station and pumping gas. Remember the days, mate, where you'd drive up to a petrol station, you'd hand them $20 and say, fill her up. And well, that was me. I was not very good at remembering how much fuel I put in the tank, so I'd often lose that job pretty quickly. But interesting enough, the computers came out kind of when I was in my teenage years, and I actually hooked up the petrol bowsers at the gas station with cables and ran them into the shop and brought in a computer and soldered those wires into the computer and actually built a terminal screen and actually had the prices of the pumps on those screens. So I actually became a software developer by accident, and that how my love of IT started back when I was probably a 15-year-old working in petrol stations.
Wow, what an amazing story. So technology, was it something you just had an aptitude for, Martin? Was it something you had an interest in, you know, kind of? Because I remember, you know, when I was, I would have been 14. I had a ZX Sinclair Spectrum, you know, one of those original, what was it, like 16K or something. And I loved it. And I used to write code but then I just wasn't my thing. For you, was it something that you were just interested in and had an aptitude for?
I was one of those very rare people who knew from an early age what I wanted to do. And my father and all my brothers and my sister all worked for Dad as accountants. And I was expected to be, you know, an accountant with my family. But yet Dad bought a K-Pro 2 computer, which came out about 1984. And I was about 15 or 14 at the time, and I'm not too sure. And I was just fascinated what these things could do, and I was just drawn to them. And so I knew straight away that I wanted to do IT. And when I finished high school, and I didn't do well in my high school grades, so I didn't get into university. So I went back and did high school again to get the grade, to get that degree program in computer science. And I probably had about 5 different careers in IT being such a broad category. But really been very fortunate to found what I loved, being cybersecurity. But as a young person, being very focused on that goal being IT, maybe a little ignorant at the time, but I was just lucky that I punted on something that turned out to be successful.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit now, because in the early 2000s, you were head of technology and chief information security officer for Bank of Queensland. And I remember post Y2K, showing our age here that we're talking about why younger people, go look it up on Wikipedia. but that was the first time we'd really started. I mean, I'm not decrying the efforts of people prior to Y2K, but we really started to think about security. You know, what kinds of things did we do in those early days, or what was the thinking at that time with regards to security?
I was very fortunate, Colin, because at Bank of Queensland, that was the era where them and like other banks were for the very first time opening up the doors of the bank to the internet. You know, they were creating version one of internet banking, version one of telephone banking. And I was in a senior leadership role there at the time. I had 2 fantastic mentors, you know, Gary Gaskell and Carl Hanmore, who were our security, you know, leaders or engineers and thought leaders there, who really taught me some very key principles that almost fast forward, you know, 20, 22 years later, still are relevant today. So I guess the business world was opening up to the internet and trying to work out how to trust it. And back then, the challenges we had to deal with were the very early versions of viruses, you know, and computer viruses that would get sent via email, the I love you virus.
Oh, yes. I forgot about that.
Remember that one?
Yeah.
That one caused mayhem for us. But, you know, the security back then was, you know, we were blocking floppy disk ports and blocking USB ports from people stealing information, or we were just doing some email security. And we were basically encrypting the whole network. I mean, we just slowed the bank down by encrypting everything. But it was very, very basic. But the principles that I learned then are just as relevant now as they were back then. So a lot of things have changed, but the principles haven't.
Security, I think, is something that cybersecurity is something we all take for granted. So you mentioned their internet banking. Most people think of internet banking as an app on their phone and wouldn't really give much thought into the technology that sits behind us being able to do that, which I imagine is super complex.
It is massive. If you look at the big banks in Australia, and they spend over each of them like $1 billion, I think, out of the big 4, the lowest amount spent on IT generally is $850 million. Some of them spend about $1.2 billion on IT. I mean, how often, Colin, do you and I walk into a branch of a bank?
Yeah,
we don't.
Never.
We pull up the app on our phone. We trust the app works. We authenticate by just typing in a PIN or looking at it. It looks at our face, and we get some biometrics from that. And we do it seamlessly. The banks are trying to push the tech back to the person and make it more convenient. And so I think it's come a long way.
So after Bank of Queensland, Martin, you spent kind of 10 years, you were with EDS, Electronic Data Systems, for 7 years, then almost 4 years at Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah.
And is that when you started to do a lot of traveling? Because you've worked across so many. How many countries have you
35.
Worked? 35. 35. Wow.
Yeah, 35 countries.
That would be a steep learning curve then in terms of dealing with different cultures, which is something I mentioned on another podcast, but we often don't think enough about how we interact with different people from different cultures. Was that something that you were given any insight into how to do, or do you pretty much have to learn as you go, Martin?
I had to learn as I went. I mean, the reality was back in those consulting days, and EDS was a fantastic place because of its culture. It just had this culture that just was amazing. It was so positive, and we could do anything at EDS. We believed any client's problem could be solved. Well, they would just chuck me on a plane and say, go, you know, I'd go to Norway, or I'd go to, you know, I'd go to Thailand or go to Indonesia. And I had to learn how to adapt my way of communicating, my way of interacting, but the way of conducting myself by, one, observing people. It's amazing how much you can learn by just watching people. But two, being authentic, and try and be yourself, you know, bring out your personality, but be mindful of how that's being received, and then ask questions, because people want to guide you. If you just ask them the question, they'll actually say, well, actually, this is kind of how we do it here. Or, and I would make big mistakes. I'd go into some of the Asian countries and I'd walk into a room, call, and I'd say, well, how can I help you? Now, I could do that in the US, or I could do that in the UK, up in Aldershot of all places. I remember doing that. And they would tell me, but, you know, in some of these Asian nations, they wouldn't do it publicly, because that's more of a private conversation. So, again, when they all stared back at me and didn't give me an answer, I realised, okay, I need to modify my style. So I've been richly blessed by having an employer pay for my travel and have someone move me around the world, but it's been very, very insightful to learn how people operate differently in each of those regions.
I read a blog from a guy called Derek Sievers just this morning, actually. If you haven't checked out Derek Sievers, people listening, if you haven't checked out Derek Sievers' 3-minute TED talk on how to create a movement, you definitely should. It's fabulous. But he talked about the fact that as humans, we grow when there's surprise and uncertainty. So when he was basically talking about himself and how he's moved from country to country and what he learned about himself. And I think that's a little bit of what you're saying there, Martin, is you learned how to communicate better. I know my communication skills have been enriched by the fact that I've worked in lots of different countries.
Yes.
And you know, I think it's great that people have that opportunity. But could we do more, do you think, within our cultures to help people become more culturally aware, such that we get greater empathy in the workplace? Do you think that's something we could do more on?
I think so, Colin. It's I don't know who taught me this, but someone taught me that often when we employ people and we're building a team, we often are looking for versions of ourselves in that process, and we'll interview someone and we'll love them because all of a sudden they are a mirror of who we are, and we hire them. And there's always a risk that we hire a team of the same people. And I think one of the great things that I saw when I was at EY, for example, I had one stage, I think I had in the team that I was part of about 8 or 12 different countries where people were from. And it was amazing to me to see the different perspectives people bring. And that actually helped us give greater value back to the problems we're trying to solve. Because I think, so I guess my point, Colin, is I think we need to be proactive and actually go and challenge ourselves and go, do I have enough diversity culturally within my team? Because they will definitely bring in a perspective that is quite disruptive to how you've thought, and you'll see problems solved in a very different way. And it's very, very powerful.
Now, you mentioned EY. So EY is short for Ernst & Young. So that's it, the first job really on your resume, as I look at it, that mentioned cybersecurity. You were director of cybersecurity, and then pretty much every role you've had since then has been cybersecurity. Do you think, I want to say the average employee, I don't really mean that.
You can say it that way, that's fine.
Do you think employees know enough about what cybersecurity is? I guess that's my first question. And then the second question, do you think the pandemic and the fact that people working remotely has affected cybersecurity policies and the way that organizations think about how they keep their information secure?
I think you've nailed it. I think, Colin, that cybersecurity was always pushed out with an element of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. I mean, it was quite alarming. And, you know, this organization has been hacked, or this organization's lost its data, or these operations have gone down. And so cybersecurity for a period of time, I guess a few years ago, was pushed out from a fear perspective. So organizations were getting into it because of that fear of disruption. But I would hate that term that, employees are the greatest risk. I mean, they'd always say, you know, what's your biggest security threat? It's your team. If you teach someone that they are the weakest point, they will behave like the weakest point. If you tell someone that they can't catch a ball or they can't shoot a basket, they will miss that basket every time. So if you keep telling people that they will, that they click on links that they shouldn't click on, if you keep telling what not to do, they will do that. So I've always been an advocate to talk about people being your greatest asset, you know, the human firewall. But since the pandemic, I mean, organizations are generally spending, you know, 10% of their IT budget year on year on cybersecurity. It's a bit like walking up an escalator backwards. You've got to go faster than the escalator. You're trying to catch up the whole time. With people working from home, organizations have jumped onto the cloud. They haven't had a 12-month kind of roadmap to plan, well, how we're going to jump onto Teams or onto Google Meets, you know, how we're going to educate people. They had weekends to turn the thing on. So they've jumped onto the cloud. There's more data sitting on the cloud than ever before. And so the methods of security, whilst the principles remain the same, the methods of how you secure that thing's a little different, a little more challenging now. I'd say it's still one of the hottest areas in the industry. Hot because there's more work than there are people. We have skill shortages. We have the great resignation and bad people moving around the industry. But also the fact that it's a global industry. You can take a job in cybersecurity and work in almost any country in the world. It's pretty exciting.
You mentioned about the security breaches. Is it hype or is it fact? I mean, every now and again we'll hear a massive breach and this data loss. You'll know better than me. I'm genuinely asking naively here. Do we make a big thing of it? Is the threat real? Are we doing enough?
The threat is real. There's an element of it because it's new. I mean, if you look at I can remember going to board meetings and spending a lot of time just educating, if that's the right word, and teaching directors really what is the risk level and what level are we willing to accept. There's a lot more happening that is not disclosed. I mean, we have laws in Australia around disclosure, but organisations have 30 days, for example, to confirm whether a breach has occurred. So there may have been a breach, but they've got 30 days to confirm it. So by the time you hear of it, it may be a little late after the fact. But a breach could be, you know, it could be as simple, Colin, as I've sent a customer spreadsheet to the wrong person on an email system. You know, oops, that's a breach. You know, or it could be a nasty person coming from the outside. So it is real, it's active, it's growing, it's getting bigger. We look at the, what's happening in Ukraine right now. Before those troops came into Russia, they launched a cyber attack to try and take down their critical infrastructure first. So it is a technique that's used. But I always say in business, cybersecurity is not about defense. It's actually about, if I can secure my organization, Colin, my organization can now move forward digitally with confidence and with that clear mindset that I can operate on the internet with the confidence that I'm actually protected.
And so other than not sending spreadsheets to people you shouldn't, oh my God, we've totally done, like I've done that. Please, can you delete the last email? I'm so sorry you've received it. I think we have in there. So what else can kind of, you know, when I say modern leaders, the leaders 2022 and beyond, people potentially moving, thinking about moving into more hybrid ways of working. What can they do then, Martin? You know, what are the responsibilities from a cybersecurity perspective?
I think the first one is you need to establish your cyber risk appetite. And what I mean by that is, how secure do I really need to be? Do I need to be secure as a bank, or can I be as secure as a small, you know, legal practice down the road in my suburb that maybe has a different threat profile? So you've got to work out how secure do I need to be, and then think about, well, what matters most, and protect what matters most first. It's a bit like saying the thief is inside my house, so what are the crown jewels that I need to protect? I think one of the problems we have, Colin, is that organizations store information and they never delete it. I mean, how many organizations, when they get a resume, keep the resume and they keep the photograph and they keep the date of birth, and when the person provides their birth certificate or their marriage certificate or their Medicare card or something as a proof of identity, the HR department stores it, and yet when the person's employed, then that organization no longer needs it. So we create these massive data sets that were relevant at a point of time but then we don't delete it when it's no longer needed. And so I think organizations, if they just remember the delete key, can actually start to reduce their threat by reduce the amount of unnecessary data that they hold.
That's great advice. Now, Martin, you've been, throughout your career, you've led teams yourself. You know, we met when we did some work with VMware recently. You're now part of a team, a really high-performing team, I have to say. How have you made that switch from kind of leading a culture to being a part of the culture? What have you brought from your experience to that team with regards to kind of enhancing how you perform and work together?
I really appreciate that question, Colin, because it's close to my heart. When I was considering VMware, I was interviewing the company, even though they were interviewing me. And in fact, we got to a process, and I can't thank my leader, Beck Moroney, enough. She allowed me to pause and think and consider and ponder. And I actually asked her, hey, I want to meet the whole team. I want to meet all the individuals that I'm going to be rubbing shoulders with to make sure that I can get on with them, and more importantly, they can get on with me, because I know, you know, I'm a pretty intense guy. So I joined a culture, not a company. And by joining a culture, that was a place that I knew that irrespective of the work that I had to do, I was in a place that I wanted to be, with people that I wanted to hang out with an organization that values its people as evidenced through its policy. See, most organizations say people are our greatest asset. Rarely have I seen people being the greatest asset when I look at how they run their businesses. They tell them to, they force them to take leave. They give them a 35-page travel policy which says why you can't book a Mars bar, you know, because even though you're traveling at 11 o'clock at night, you know. We organizations make it so hard for people, yet I was attracted to VMware because it at least at the surface level, the time when I was interviewing, I could see evidence that it actually did value its people by the way in which it looked after its people, and that was important to me. At this stage in my career, I'm not chasing the remuneration levels as I did in the past. I'm not chasing certain things. I'm chasing places where I can be that I think are giving value back to the community, back to business, but part of a high-performance team where we do amazing things together.
Yeah, we talk a lot about high performance, Martin, and certainly in my experience and in my opinion as well, I think that you get high performance when there is a connection between teammates, when you actually take the time to agree how you'll work together. You make space for kind of open dissension, which is done in a very highly emotionally intelligent way. And the fact that you took the time to interview the company, I think, is to your credit. Do you think that kind of that's the way that we're moving culturally? Are we seeing more and more people who are looking for these elements because they recognize that actually happiness is more important than pay?
Without doubt, we're seeing more purpose-driven employment. People have the power to move now because, look, to be honest, Colin, you can do your job for 20 different companies from your home office now. So you don't have to consider certain things about travel and distances like before. People are now purpose-driven and they're looking for organizations that have purpose. And they're very serious about that because they're realizing that there's a lot more to life and a lot more to their career than just the rewards of employment itself. They're looking for actually contributing their skill to the betterment of society. So we're seeing that, and we're seeing that especially the younger ones who are coming out of university, you know, they're looking at organizations at their ESG policy. They're, you know, do they have good environmental policies? The last question they ask is, how much are you going to pay me? You know, the first question is, you know, what's your views on days off? You know, so it's changing in a good way. What's your observation, Colin?
Yeah, no, same thing. Certainly from, you know, some of the Gen Z millennials that I speak to, they want to know, you know, we saw it recently in the news where Atlassian, quite a forward-thinking culture, who said, you know, sending peace and love to our friends in Ukraine, and staff was like, yeah, that's not enough. We want to know what else are you doing? What are you doing to cut off service to Russia to send the message? You know, that was the pressure that being brought to bear. Completely agree about environmental policies, but also that they want to know that they're not joining a toxic culture with old-fashioned leadership. They want to join forward-thinking organizations that give them the space and opportunity to grow and, you know, see happiness and purpose in everything they do.
Yeah, I think for me, my observation has been, and I guess I've been working for, you know, 30 years now, is that integration with your team, that connectedness with your team often occurs when you've had to get very deep with each other. You know, you've had to get down and dirty and you've had conflict and you've had some seriously hard stuff to work on together. They become your best mates. You know, when you've, and it just takes time. You can't create it by just doing 3-day workshops. You've got to create it by actually getting in deep. And I find that level of integration works over time. But you know very quickly the individuals. You get a nose for it as the types of, you know, the types of connections that work best in teams. And you need that diversity in the team, because if you get a team of Collins or you get a team of Martys, you've only got to get one. You've got to get that diversity of thinking in, and then you've got to challenge the way in which you guys work, but be comfortable being challenged. And that's what I find is one of the trick with greatly integrated teams is people who are comfortable being wrong, people who don't have to be the smartest person in the room, people who will listen to other people's point of views, and people will want to learn from each other.
That's fabulous insights, Martin. You mentioned the workshop. You're absolutely right. 3-day workshop, you build the foundations, you don't build the house. Now, just mentioning the workshop, because I caught the end of a conversation, I was totally earwigging. So my last question. So you've got a black book from 1992, I think it was.
I do.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that to close us out? You've got it. It's right there.
I've got it.
Yeah.
So in 1992, Colin, I would write at the end of the week things that I'd learnt, because I was straight out of university and I was doing technical work and I would often forget. So I'd write little lessons learnt, and then I'd start to write down little sayings of my bosses or my managers. And instinctively, I kept that book and kept adding to it. Now, that book has continued to get bigger and bigger and has eventually become electronic. But I've written up a series of about 12 values that I live by. And these may be quotes. They're all quotes of other people, of all my own thoughts, of things that I've really learned over the years. One of them is, if it were my daughter, what would I do? You know, so, you know, when I look at people in the workplace and I interact with them, you know, how would I want to interact with them? I should interact with them in the way in which I would want someone to interact with my daughter. You know, in a nice way, in a positive way, in a candid way, but, you know, in a respectful way. And so these are little lessons that I've learned, and I maybe it sounds a little old fashioned, but I've got it electronically now. But I actually live by them, and often I'll use them in part of my resolution process.
Fabulous. We're always on a growth journey, right, Martin? There's always something that we can learn from other people to help us on our own pathway. This has been fabulously insightful, Martin. Thanks so much for taking the time to share some insights with us and your journey, and for joining us on the Culture Makers podcast.
Absolutely, Colin. It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with colleagues and friends or your connections on social media. Better still, why not keep the conversation going and join our community of culture makers for free? Share information from around the world on how to create a great place to work. You can join us at www.culturemakers.community.